are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview, and tonight we are going to be joined by Dave. You want to tell us a little about your guest?
I will. I'm joined by Richard Terrell. He's back again with his book of essays titled Essentially. Richard's essays have appeared widely in journals such as River Teeth, Crazy Horse, and New Letters, as well in various collections. He's an award-winning writer. You must check out his poetry. And he's been a lifelong teacher, 40 years of teaching. We had chatted earlier, roughly 40 years, and many of those in Mankato. And this book is out from Holy Cow Press, our friends from Duluth. We love Holy Cow. We love our local publishers. And we love Jim up there in Duluth.
So, I thought I was your main friend from Duluth.
Well, yes, you are.
Just kidding. Holy Cow is too.
Yep.
After the break, we'll be airing an interview between me and Mari Naomi, a prolific graphic novelist, about their newest graphic novel, I Thought You Loved Me. And also just a quick shout out at the top of the hour that it is Pledge Week.
Pledge Week.
Bow, bow, bow.
Yep. Let's go, people.
If you want to support KFAI, which is your independent, nonprofit community radio for Minnesota's communities, we do book reviews, but we also do amazing new music. We have shows in all kinds of different language made by a variety of communities here. You can get in on supporting all that goodness and get some merch for yourself in the mail by calling 612-375-9030 or pledging on the internet from wherever you are at kfai.org. And without further ado, take us into your interview, Dave.
Thank you, Annie, and welcome back, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you back again. So we're going to talk about your new book, Essentially, a collection of essays, and we're going to hear from that book. But before we do, I'd like to have you talk about the essay form in the sense of how you got involved in writing essays. We're going to talk about the essay form later if we have time, but what day did you wake up and say, I'm going to be an essayist?
Oh, that's a pretty good story. I'll have to try to make it a short story. But I was teaching in South Korea, and 40 years ago, and I was still writing poems exclusively. And, you know, I was there for a year, and it was kind of travel experience. Everything's new. Mm-hmm. And my poems got longer and longer and longer.
Interesting.
And I came back, and I was moved back to Wisconsin. And a friend of mine, John Hildebrand, who's a really good nonfiction writer in Wisconsin, said, have you ever thought about trying to write prose?
Huh.
You know, because your poems are getting so long. So then a couple years later, I went to China, and I taught in China for a year.
Right.
And I went there with the idea of writing a memoir. And I did. And so that got me going on prose. And I still do poems as well, as you know, because I was
of
here
course.
With my last book a couple of years ago.
Yes. Well, that's great. And again, hopefully, as time permits, I want to talk about the essay form later on. But with that introduction, how about setting us up with a reading? Tell us what you're going to read, and let's hear you.
Yeah, there's among the topics in this book, they're varied, but a lot of the essays have to do with either music or the outdoors. And then the last section of the book gets into aging, which at my age is is a logical subject to take up. So I'm going to read this essay called "The World Away," and one thing I wanted to do with this, I always wanted to start an essay in the middle of a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I've done here. Gave the book designer Fitz. It starts with an ellipses. So dot, dot, dot. Nor are we tempted to sing praises of the beauty of portages, like the one along the Basswood River called the Horse Portage. According to our outfitter, before the Boundary Waters and Quetico were the large wilderness parks they are today, loggers did indeed use horses to haul equipment on this mile and a quarter long trail. You feel like a horse or a Spartan slave doing the horse portage. And if, like us, you're not hefty enough to carry both a pack and a canoe in the same trip, you cross each portage three times, there and back and there again, so a mile and a quarter portage like this one becomes nearly a four-mile walk, two-thirds of it under the weight of what you foolishly thought you had to bring on your canoe trip.
Mm-hmm.
I start such portages feeling fresh and confident, finish them feeling thirsty, sore, and overmatched. It always seems to be raining on a portage, or it has rained and the trail is slick rock and deep puddles. Being young or in outstanding physical condition should not be allowed in this wilderness. Those who fit that description can never know how good a cold swim feels in the evening after such work that you're not in shape for. They can't know the numbing taste of the first sip of rum that night, or how much more silent silence is when you've been humbled by your middle-aged body. And then a bit later I say, we're all on some kind of portage in the Quetico and beyond. This is an idea so corny, so obviously symbolic as to almost have to be true. We all schlep things, packs, the food we need to eat, the shelter we need to stay out of the rain. We also bear crosses. In between the varied experiences of our excursions, the scenery we see going by in life, there has to be this drudgery that turns muscles and tendons to salty twine. Drudgery looking at its own feet. I have all the character I need, thanks, and this won't build any more. We're always walking between two lakes, the known lake of the present and the unknown lake that's next and which is always more beautiful because you haven't seen it yet. This is the world away from the known world, the next world that awaits.
Thank you. That was Richard Terrell reading from essentially his new collection of essays out from Holy Cow Press in Duluth. So, Richard, you mentioned poetry early on, and I know you as a poet, but this is one of the essays which made me think about poetry when I was reading them because it's beautifully written. It's evocative of nature. And it made me wonder how you decided to write an essay versus a poem about these experiences in nature.
That's a good question. It always seems to be pretty easy to decide that, but I don't know if I can generalize about it. I guess poetry, in this case, I had maybe more of a concept of the whole of it, describing the portage. To do it in a poem, I would have to be so brief.
Yeah.
It would be so truncated. And usually with a poem, I like it not to end up being about what I started writing about.
Sure.
So it might start writing about a portage, but I find in the next draft it's not about canoeing at all. It's about fishing or playing chess or something. Whereas with this, the subject matter was important to me. And poetry, I think you don't want to be corralled by a subject. You need to let it flow.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, nice Finnegan's Wake move, starting with an open sentence at the beginning. Very nice. So you really had me at the get-go with this collection, Richard, your opening essay, Solstice, about your mother experiencing memory issues. Both of my parents are still alive, and both are experiencing similar things. And lead me to wonder, to what degree, and I ask this of poets often, and may have asked it of you also, but to what degree are other people in your life exposed, laid bare on the page for you? Well, do you have any boundaries, any rules here?
Yeah, I taught creative nonfiction writing for 27 years at Minnesota State in the graduate program. And that is one of the things we talk about. I call it the responsibility issue. That we'll put it this way. Joan Didion, one of the great nonfiction writers, said, the nonfiction writer is always selling somebody out.
Interesting.
And it's... It's unavoidable.
Yeah.
So I think what I used to tell my students is write it all down. Don't leave anything out and then go back and see if there's some things that you just don't want to say and cut them out. But you have to write it all first.
Yeah.
You can't stifle it. That's one point. And I think then you have to decide for yourself if it's worth the price. Oh, and the other thing is tell the truth. Because if you tell the truth and you treat all characters fairly, then some of those stinging details won't maybe be so hurtful to yourself or others. And the other thing is to be hard on yourself as well as the narrator. The character of yourself. Don't put yourself up above people. If you reveal your own flaws, then you have license to give a more complete portrait of others.
That's excellent advice. I hope everyone's paying attention. We just got schooled on how to write nonfiction. I'm recalling now, I won't name names and enough time has passed, but I interviewed an essayist once who said, yes, I'll be on your show, but please don't ask me about this and that essay because it's causing me more trouble than I thought. Well, how did this get to press? It happens, I guess.
It happens, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm more sort of alive to that idea when I read from now on. You mentioned music, and that came to mind as I was reading your essays also. You are a musician of sorts. You play.
Yes.
And so I want to ask you about parallels, if any, between music and writing. either as a composer and a writer or as a guy who picks up a sax and a guy who picks up one of these pens and starts playing.
Yeah, I don't write music, but jazz is an improvisatory art. So in a sense, I'm making up music as I go along. One difference is that writing is something you do alone and music is something you do with other people. Mm-hmm. And therefore, music is a lot more fun because you've got your bandmates and you have an audience immediately.
Right.
Writing, you never see your audience. Even if you're giving a reading, you know, it's still not the same as playing for an audience. I mean, if I play a good solo, people will applaud. But nobody applauds when I write a good sentence. I look over my shoulder. It's not happening. So that's...
True.
The other difference in the composition of it is that with music, unless you're doing something in the studio where people are turning a bunch of knobs, you don't get to revise. But writing is revision. The real writing happens in the second and third and fourth and 10th and 20th draft. Whereas jazz, you may play things that you've practiced when in your solo, but what comes out, that's it. That's it. No revision.
I've read, and you have two writers talk about jazz and how maybe not their own writing is like jazz, but critics saying this writer is jazz inspired. It's like listening to jazz. What does that mean to you? And what is your music? What do your words sound like?
Well, I mean, what that means to me is that, again, I was a teacher, so is that the process in the early drafts has to be like an improvisation. You can't control it too tightly. I mean, if you think about it, this isn't an idea that I thought of. But
right.
You know, whenever you speak a sentence, you're improvising. You start the sentence, you never know how it's going to end exactly.
Yeah.
So writing has to be like that times 10, and then you go back and revise. But I think with a lot of writers, because we value candor in our culture, that they still want the end product to feel like it's just improvised or just emoted, you know, that it's not too polished in order to sound natural. And that also is jazz-like, I think.
Yeah, interesting. What's also difficult, or you don't want to have it be too forced or contrived and more improvised, is humor.
Yeah.
And I want to read from a couple of snippets from your essays here. This is from The Vantage. It's the elderly section, if you will, which I can relate to. And I'll just cut it to the quick here. The stranger who, when I said I'd turned 60, partly asked, but mostly said, "Yeah, but how old do you feel?" And I answered, 60. I laughed out loud, Richard. and then in another, going to the dogs, I'm going to call you out on this. You write, "People shouldn't write about their pets. I know that. Nor should they tell funny stories about their pets at already stultifying dinner parties. The only thing worse in those settings is people telling funny stories about their grandchildren, and so on." I could go on and read this, but I found that to be very funny. But also, you say people shouldn't write about their pets. I know that. And then you proceed to write
and
about your pets.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
So, which is also funny.
Yeah.
How do you handle humor? Let's just ask it directly.
Oh, well, humor is a device. I can tell you the value of it for me is that if you can say funny things, then you can turn around and say something that is heartfelt, serious, maybe devastating, and you can sneak it in.
Yeah, that's good.
Because, you know, you've got the reader laughing, and then you've, again, I'll use the word license, you have the license to say something maybe sentimental, maybe, you know, something over the top that if the whole essay were like that, people would, you know, throw up or something.
Yeah.
But humor allows you to get the serious part. And also, I think, for me, part of the essay writing is I like to try to say things that are a little outrageous sometimes and test them out and see how much of the statement is true. Mm. And humor is, of course, the best way to do that because you're allowed in humor to exaggerate.
Yes.
So I say all kinds of things in this book that if you put a gun to my head, I say, well, no, I don't really believe that.
Sure.
But it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Made you think, didn't it? You know, so humor is one way to sneak in ideas.
Speaking of sneaking, does humor sneak into your writing? That is to say, you talk about writing improvisationally and jazz-like. Suddenly, something funny happens along the way, and you surprise yourself.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I think More often, well, maybe you can remember better than I can, but in these essays, the ones that are humorous are pretty much humorous from the start.
Yeah.
Or like the one I just read, I mean, it's not laugh out loud funny, but I'm complaining about how much it hurts.
Yes.
But then later, I'm allowed to appreciate nature and talk about how beautiful everything is, which would be pretty sappy if I just did that for the whole essay.
Yeah, yeah. Remind our listeners, we are speaking with Richard Terrell about his new collection of essays titled Essentially, out from Holy Cow Press in Duluth. And it is Pledge Week, day one of Pledge Week Plus, I guess. We're on for more than a week. Please give us a call at 612-375-9030 or kfai.org. $5, $10, we're not fussy. And give us some love at right on radio here. We would appreciate that, too. So how about another reading, okay. Richard?
Yeah, I'll read. There's a long essay in the second section of the book, which is essays about music, jazz, and film. And this is on the jazz pianist Bill Evans, who I've loved for years. My band plays a lot of his music. We do Bill Evans shows where we play only Bill Evans music.
Okay, before you go on, what's the name of the group?
The Larry McDonough Quartet.
Wonderful. Yeah. I'm writing it down.
Okay. the name of it is Who is Bill Evans? And the name of the essay. Mm-hmm. And I call it that because, you know, nobody knew who this guy really was. He was just a mystery to even the people who were closest to him. And it starts out with a list of assertions, things that are true about Bill Evans, just simple statements, some of them even banal, perhaps. So who was Bill Evans? Start here. His music, like his personality, had a questioning quality. Two, he wasn't a narcissist, apparently. Three, he sought the essence of the material in its harmonic implications. Four, Miles Davis said, "It's a drag, he's dead. Now I'll never get to hear him play Alfie again." Mm. Five, he started as a flute player. Six, he didn't live as long as he might have otherwise. He didn't live to be old. Seven, whereas many people don't eat properly when they're kids, he didn't eat properly at the end of his life. Malnutrition was listed as a contributing cause of death. Coffee, also cocaine. Eight, he loved to golf, bowl. Nine, his longtime girlfriend Elaine threw herself in front of a subway train in 1970. Wow. Ten, he had lifelong feelings of inadequacy. 11, he played early on with Sax's Herbie Fields, whose career ended tragically in suicide. 12, he was left-handed, which may account in part for his chordal proficiency. 13, he wasn't African-American, and he never resided permanently in a foreign country to escape racial prejudice at home. 14, at his death, Oscar Peterson said, maybe he found what he was looking for. 15, he knew a great deal about the novels of Thomas Hardy and the poetry of William Blake. 16, loan sharks threatened to break his hands. 17, he said, I had to work harder at music than most cats because, you see, man, I don't have very much talent. Thesis. Why would one of the great artists of his day be so self-destructive as to kick a heroin habit only to start a cocaine habit? When I get into something, I really get into it, he is known to have said. Does that explain? Shortly before his death, he told his young bass player how amazed he was at the insidiousness of his new drug. We can read that his life was a 50-year-long suicide. We can read that he was a nice man, had a sense of humor better than your grandfather's, wanted a child, and when he had one, thought his life was complete, then moved out from his family. Dying of cocaine, he thought he was happy. Some jazz musician junkies played the music only to get money to score. Chet Baker would forget his trumpet on a bandstand in his haste to shoot up. Charlie Parker had to borrow money for cab fare. But Bill Evans practiced constantly. I heard him practice Ravel, Debussy, his wife Nanette said after his death. But I never heard him practice jazz. He said, you don't understand. It's like death and transfiguration. Every day you wake in pain like death, and then you go out and score, and that is transfiguration. Each day becomes all life in microcosm.
Thank you. That's Richard Terrell reading from essentially his new book of essays. And if essays can be a page-turner, this one's a page-turner for me. I encourage you to pick this book up and finish Bill Evans. I'm glad you read this, Richard, because recently I got the New York Review of Books. There's a long essay in it about essays. Oh. I'll pass this on to you. But it made me think of your collection, of course, because obviously I'm reading them both at the same time, but also, what is the essay form? I mean, this essay, I wouldn't think this is what an essay looks like. I mostly think of essays as wall-to-wall carpeting in terms of words. Long paragraphs and really serious things. And here we go with a list.
Yeah.
What is an essay form? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, this is, I would call what this essay does, fragmentations. I just read two sections, the list section and the section called thesis. And there, I haven't counted them. Probably 15 sections in this essay. None is as long as a page.
Mm-hmm.
Some have titles, some don't.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is really this: the form of this essay is almost like a poem.
Yeah,
and the parts are almost like stanzas or perhaps lines, and they bounce off of each other by just their being juxtaposed next to each other, or maybe five pages later, they recall something earlier in the essay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one technique that you can use, especially if it's not a story. If you're not telling a story, if it's not a narrative, well, you can either organize things as you would in expository writing, having a thesis and supporting it and arguing and so on. But creative nonfiction usually doesn't do that. It usually doesn't have a thesis. I was being ironic when I called that section thesis.
Sure.
You know, because this whole essay doesn't answer the question, who was Bill Evans?
Yeah.
It tries to answer.
Yeah.
And I think because...
That's poetic.
Because it's... Nobody knows. I can't answer it either.
Right.
That's why this form of juxtaposing the small sections is, I thought, would be appropriate for this, because I couldn't pretend that I knew the answers.
Yeah.
I just gave you what I found out through research and listening.
Yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable, but we are in the two-minute warning, Richard. Isn't that something? So I have numerous other questions, but just in case we run out of time, and we will, tell us about what you're working on next and what we can expect from you.
Well, I don't know.
Oh, there we go.
I can't tell you. I have some appearances. Can I plug
them? Yes, please. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tuesday, November 15th, I'll be in the Readings by Writer series at the University Club in St. Paul on Summit Avenue. That's a really great reading series.
Awesome.
And on December 8th, the Midstream reading series at Unity Church Unitarian, and I'll be reading it. I think maybe my piano player is going to come, and we're going to do a little music beforehand.
Hey, Richard, mention that Summit group again. What's the name of that?
Oh, Readings by Writers.
Readings by Writers. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, at the University Club. It's the long-running series in the Twin Cities.
Thank you for that.
The band Larry McDonough Quartet, another commercial here.
Ooh.
December 10th at KJ's Hideaway, the old Artist Quarter.
Oh, yeah.
In St. Paul.
Great venue, kids.
And on December 23rd, our Festivus for the Rest of Us program at the Astor Cafe.
Oh, I love
where
the
Astor. Do our Seinfeld thing, and we will have feats of strength and airing of grievances and jazz.
Oh, my God, I can't wait.
So that's what I'm doing now is what I'm doing is talking to people about this book.
Good you
know,
for you.
I'll make it quick.
Yep.
If I did have a project, I probably wouldn't tell you about it because
I
don't want to talk about stuff I haven't written yet.
So you can
decide if I'm lying or not, whether I have a project going.
And I believe you're also on our calendar that Eric's going to be reading shortly.
Ah.
You have something up next week. And maybe you don't even know it, but I hope someone tells you about it. we'll get to that later. But Richard, it's been a delight and a pleasure, and it went too fast, as it always does.
Always.
A treat to have you on. Please come back and back and back. Keep writing, and I know you will.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having
Richard
me.
Richard Terrell, essentially new book of essays out from Holy Cow Press. Check it out, everyone. And now this.
Welcome to the Pledge Corner, everyone. Liz, are you here?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can. We have a special caller. And by special caller, I mean really valuable team member who is home tonight calling in. Liz, what do you want to tell us on this wonderful Pledge Week season?
Just two brief things. The first thing is, Write on Radio is a show that brings you authors like the last one. You won't hear interviews by essay writers. You just won't hear that anywhere else. And so that's one of the reasons that donating to Write on Radio is good. And the second reason is that because we do long-form interviews, a half hour rather than 5 or 10 minutes, we can go into depth. We can ask questions that are more serious and that will bring out more interesting information. A half-hour interview is so much more nice than a five-minute interview. And so these are two reasons why you should donate to Write on Radio today, 612-375-9030, or on the web at kfai.org.
Yes, couldn't have said it better myself, Liz, so thank you so much. I just want to add on to that and echo what Liz was saying. As someone who has worked in publishing, who has written book reviews on a freelance basis, having the space and the autonomy to truly bring books forth because you believe in them and getting long spans of time between 30 minutes and an hour to talk about them honestly is not common. And I feel really lucky to be here and to have that platform. And I try my best to use it to bring diverse, intellectually engaging content. After the break here, we're going to be talking to Mari Naomi, who's a great independent queer comics maker. And it's just so nice to be on non-commercial radio and be able to do that. And KFAI is what makes that happen. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Dave?
Yeah. So where else are you going to hear someone reading from their book? And maybe you guys have already covered this. I had to step out for a moment. An extended passage or passages from their work on radio live here in the Twin Cities. Nowhere else is that happening, even on quote-unquote public radio stations who say they're dedicated to the arts. Well, we really give time to the arts, a lot of time to the arts, and you're not going to find it anywhere else. And we're all volunteers, by the way. Everyone on the soundboard, everyone on the mic is a volunteer, so we don't need that much to keep going, but we could use a little bit of love this week. KFAI.org, right, Annie?
Yes, and it's amazing how much can get done here if we just have enough funding to have the lights on, to have the sound on. The number of people that I meet here who are so dedicated and so creative and bring perspectives that you wouldn't hear on more nationalized public radio is really inspiring. And all these people donate their time. All they need is a little upstart money to like put the lights on, keep the tower on IDS going. Yeah, it's really great to be on this station. And if anything you could throw our way at 612-375-9030 or kfai.org is much appreciated. Also, you don't have to do it entirely for non-selfish reasons, because there is really cute retro looking merch. Oh. all designed by local artists.
Great.
I definitely get compliments on the merch when I wear it. So
great swag.
Yeah.
Wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I was reading, and this is a book people comment, I was reading an Alison Bechdel book last year, who now is like nationally award-winning. Mm-hmm. One of her books got made into a Broadway play. I was reading the last Alison Bechdel book, and there was a character in one of the books wearing a KFAI merch shirt.
All right.
Yeah, so be part of the legacy, y'all. Be part of the legacy and get your KFAI merch shirt.
Oh, that is wonderful.
Yeah.
So last but not least, if we're ready, one of the cool things we do is a weekly calendar of events.
Yes. Our newest member, the wonderful, wonderful Eric, is going to kick off our calendar. So I'll start up the tune for that. Liz, thank you so much for stopping by.
Liz, good
vocally.
To hear from you.
You bet.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM and on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie on Write on Radio, and I'm so excited to have Mari Naomi returning to the show. Mari Naomi's latest graphic memoir, is I Thought You Loved Me, available soon. And they are a prolific author of other graphic memoirs and graphic books for young readers and adult readers. Welcome to the show, Mari.
Thank you. So nice to be back.
Thank you. So tell me a little bit about I Thought You Loved Me.
Well, I could talk about this for years. Actually, the radio cannot see it, but I'm holding up my book. It is, as you mentioned, a graphic memoir, and it is about a complicated friendship that I had throughout my teens and 20s. And one day she ghosted me, and then 20 years later, I was ready to write about it and get over everything that had happened. And I decided to write a book about it. I didn't necessarily think that I would publish the book, but I thought that might be a possibility. So I did keep that in mind when I started writing about it. And what I was surprised by, I had very few memories of the friendship. She was my first girl kiss. We spent just so much time together, but all of that was pretty much wiped out of my brain. And so really the book is me trying to remember things so that I could get over the friendship, and also just other things along the way that I've forgotten, and also kind of doing a deep dive into memory and what that means and how, you know, how reliable is that. In a nutshell.
Yeah. To elaborate a little on that, as you mentioned now and mentioned in the book, you revisited some old journals to kind of plot out this book, and you saw experiences and memories and photos that you just had no memory of. What did it feel like to recreate something that you don't remember? And did it ever feel like your fiction work at all?
It did not feel like fiction at all, mostly because I was like, this book is really different in that it's sort of a process book. So I feel like I'm taking the reader along with me as I'm figuring out not only what went on in my brain and what was going on in my friendship, but also going through the process of making a book and figuring out the narrative of memoir, which is one of the hardest things about writing memoir, is figuring out what is the story here and how to end. And throughout the beginning of this book, and as I'm, the book is told kind of chronologically as I'm making the book, I really not know how the story was going to end, or if it would end, or it would even have a narrative to it. And all my other books were more carefully plotted out, whereas this was definitely like I'm taking the reader along for a ride here. And a lot of it has to do with me going through my old journals for many, many years of them, and sharing excerpts and sharing letters that we exchanged and stuff like that. It's a very unusual book. It's because I used not only comics to tell the story, but collage and old letters and just ephemera. It's all over the place. It's a pretty bizarre book.
I love the kind of texture that the book takes on because of the fact that a lot of it is done in collage. Like for those who haven't seen parts of the book online or anything like that, a lot of images in the book are cut. There's like illustration layered with cut images of flowers or water or wood or other textures, which really gives poignant but simple illustrations like an extra dimension sort of. Could you tell me kind of your process creating that style and what you wanted to do with that style?
Sure. I've been practicing. I've always done collage. I always loved collage, but it's very hard on my hands because of the scissors and all that. Like, it's just, if you're someone who draws for a living, it's a really bad idea to get into collage or anything that involves like X-Acto blades or scissors, especially if you're older and you're getting towards the age of arthritis, which I'm getting towards there. And I've also had like probably carpal tunnel issues and back issues. So like, it's not something that I was able to do a whole lot of. There were a number of years where I was working on a life-size self-portrait collage. And it was double-sided, so it's about 6 feet across, double-sided, and it was just, and there, it's actually featured in the book, and that's sort of what I based the whole book on, like, aesthetically. Unfortunately, so I spent years making this, and it was destroyed by accident by a gallery before it ever got shown, and I was devastated, and it's still really sad to me that, you know, it never got to see the light of day. So in some ways, this is my way of giving it the light of day, is by showing it in the book. But the collage is called Life, I think it was Love and Death. And it shows in one side, it's me, cat filled with roses, and just on a bed of grass. And it's all made from tiny bits of collage that I've been collecting for years and years and years. And on the other side, it's me in the sky, also filled with other kinds of flowers at the end of the book. And I cut out lots of bits of sky and clouds and stuff like that. And that's kind of where I started from. And I quickly started thinking a lot about visual metaphor. And the cover of the book is those purple flowers that kind of hang from trellises. They're very smelly. I love the smell of them. But the thing is, every time I smell them, like it gives me a deja vu feeling, because it just wakes something up from my memory. And so I made a collage of a bunch of these flowers that I photoed, and I did the collage in Procreate on the iPad. And that's actually what changed everything, was it's so much easier to do collage on the iPad than it is to cut out pictures. So it made it really easy and accessible for me. And so these purple flowers symbolize memory. And so every time you see them in the book, like you see like a faint whiff of them, that means part of my memory is coming back. And when you see them at Porsche, that means I'm having like an intense, oh my God, epiphany of like, oh, this is what happened. I'm remembering everything. Ah, I got chills. But like pretty much every image in this book, and there are hundreds, thousands of them, I don't know, they all have meaning in some way or another, but I never explain them. And I'm hoping that they'll kind of be intuited by the reader as they go along. It's not an easy book, honestly. it's a difficult book. It's not like a beach read. It's definitely something that you're plumbing the depths of my brain. And I'm hoping to help the reader actually go through their own brain and like bring up thoughts about friendship means and memory and like what, you know, how different memories can constantly be changing for yourself and others. It's very complicated.
I had noticed the, I have been considering asking you actually about the kind of the purplish flowers that are used with you throughout the book, like when something dramatic is happening. So I appreciate you bringing that up, of like when a realization is happening or something like that. And it was just interesting to see emotion and realization depicted in and emphasized in a non-human way. Like obviously the you that is realizing these things is human, but the way that you use kind of non-human life forms or non-human textures to emphasize emotion was really interesting in reading this book, that kind of was a lot about the forces of the world or like how people process the world around them. Yeah, just a thought.
Cool. Yeah. If you're curious, the roses are symbolic of love, specifically for my friend, or trust and love in my friend. And I kind of go between using collage of real roses and collage of fake roses, and you can take what you want from that. And when I'm filled with the roses, not always, but on most of the occasions when I'm filled with the roses, that means I'm trust and love her. And when the roses are outside of my body, that's kind of like this tenuous state of like, wait, what's going on? And so they're not there at all, which means like there's kind of a disconnect. And she's also represented by this sort of mossy green. I believe I looked up the plant afterwards, and it's licorice, but I didn't want to know while I was making it. I just found this plant in the wild and I took a photo. I'm like, okay, this is going to be Jody. This reminds me of her in a lot of ways. So yeah, throughout the book, like, I mean, you could point to anything and I'll tell you what it means.
When you're taking these images that are so charged with meaning or association for you, and then adding an illustration on it to like literalize it a little more, like the licorice plant is Jody, but also you're like literally drawing woman on top of it to like make it clear who it is, that it's your friend. How do you decide a level of specificity versus simplicity in that image. Like, there are so many images in the book where it's something that's so simple but so poignant. Like, there's a page that I just love that is a photo of a ripple of water, and then there's a thin outline of a hand emerging from it. Like, how did you choose the amount to draw over, or the amount to enhance, or was it just kind of more intuition?
It was mostly intuition, but there was a lot of try, fail. Like, there, that particular image, I went through so many iterations for. That was originally a photo that I took of a duckling in a pond. And I basically just drew out the duckling, which was like the most painful thing I've ever had to do, because that duckling was cute. I'm like, I don't want to erase the duckling. But, you know, for the purpose of metaphor, and I mean, it's that one I think is a little heavy handed, because it's like me literally drowning and reaching out for a network of support from friends or whatever. And that's part of the book. And I really just had to think about that a lot, because I'm like, well, how easy do I want to make this for people to understand? But heavy handed, get it, because it's a oh no. there was a lot of trying and then trying again and trying again until I had it right. Just that one especially. But it was hard. That was really hard, because you don't want to overdo it. With the character Jody, who this book is about, like I kind of didn't want to show her face at all. But there's a couple, like towards the end, you sort of see her face a little more. But particularly during the times where I wasn't sure who she was, like I thought it was important to keep her kind of nebulous.
Yeah, having a very simple drawing of someone and then kind of backfilling it with other colors and textures and stuff was a good capturing of the way that someone can mean different things to you in different points of your life, or you can feel differently towards them at different points of your life.
Yeah, part of it too was just me, like, yeah, not really knowing who she was. Like, I thought I knew her, but then did I really know her? So it's like, there's a lot of just intuitive drawing there, definitely.
So in this book, you confront past regrets and misunderstandings and mistakes pretty openly, which I think is the mark of a good memoir. It's always interesting to see how someone reckons with their regrets while also creating, a cohesive notion of themselves learning from it and moving forward. How did it feel to draw your mistakes and share them? And how did that inform how you shaped this narrative?
So in the other memoirs that I've done, I've been really, really far away from the subject matter. So where I had enough perspective, like distance or just emotional distance, at least, where I was able to kind of see, hey, that is not black and white. I didn't want to demonize anyone. I didn't want to idealize anyone. I don't want to blame myself too much, because then that's just another form of, you know, it's a little emotionally dishonest. And so that's sort of my rule with doing memoir, is like, well, you know, get enough space and then you can write about it. And in this case, like, even though there was a lot of time space, my emotional space was not as advanced as I wanted it to be, which was part of why this was like supposed to be a cathartic writing versus everything else I've done. So I'm really used to putting all my faults out there. Like, I think that's kind of the fun part of memoir, is to admit, like, hey, look, I'm a dope. Like, it's no fun as a reader to read for someone just like, this person wronged me, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's like, sometimes I feel that way. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm the victim, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I feel like I'm the jerk. And I feel like the reality is usually somewhere in between that, when it's something pretty complicated, which is pretty much everything. Like, I don't believe that there are any actual evil people in the world. I don't think there are many actually good people in the world. Like, people are people, and we make mistakes, and we have good times and bad times and whatever. So I'm pretty comfortable with putting my faults out there. But it was sort of like, you could tell in this book that I was still sorting things out, because I'm like, well, what part did I play in this relationship? So when I was doing that, I was definitely trying to sort things out, and mm-hmm. I hadn't come to a conclusion yet, mm-hmm. Which is that, and that's very unusual for me as a writer to be writing about, because I didn't know, like, what role did I play? Who was I in that friendship? Who was she? And I think I've trained myself enough to not be self-conscious when I'm writing. The self-conscious time comes now when I'm putting it out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
I've trained myself. I've been doing this for, I don't know, since 1997. So I've trained myself not to worry about what other people are going to think while I'm in it.
Yeah.
But now.
Yeah. It's nice to have writing out in the world about, that talks about issues of like hurt and morality and stuff like that, that provides a nuanced discussion, because I think it's too simple to either assume that people can never change or that people can never be wrong. And it's nice to have a example of someone genuinely going through a reckoning and being like, oh, I'm hurt, but also did I hurt the other person? And then kind of allowing it to evolve and allowing people to really process and take accountability. And that's something I love about how long chronologically this memoir spans. Like, you start pretty young and it goes decades and decades. And I feel like a lot of friendship stories are relatively short. They're usually about younger people. And it's nice to see a book with like huge changes and twists and turns. I don't want to spoil anything, but there is someone who makes some pretty unkind and possessive and bad choices towards others, and then someone else's unkindness turns out to not be what it seems, not to be just way too cryptic, but and like, it really throughout the book, kind of how, at least how I felt as a reader about whether forgiveness was warranted or not, really changed throughout. Kind of as you were going, this might have changed as you were writing, but like, what did you want to convey by creating a picture of life that goes that long and encompasses that much change?
I wasn't particularly trying to convey anything other than just my own navel gazing, truly. But what I wanted to do, and what I would like to see more of, is basically put more realistic friendships out in the world. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've seen a lot of, you know, movies and stuff that involve female friendships. They're always revolving around some guy, or revolving around romance, or, you know, something like, often like a male is like the center of all of it. And like, there are men in this story, but like, that's not who this story is about. But you know, they're kind of side players, but like, mm-hmm. I just haven't seen a lot of, well, first of all, in literature, like I read a few books that involve like female friendship, and, you know, and actually the only one I could think about is Margaret Atwood's Cat's Eye, which I thought and I've heard that there's one other that people keep referring to when they talk about my book, but I've never read it. I think it's called My Beautiful Friend, which I intend to read, but I haven't read it yet. But like,
Elena Ferrante, My Brilliant Friend?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because that's the only other book that I've read that has a female friendship that spans this long.
Because I don't want to start getting into my head and start comparing. But yeah. In general, I want to encourage more people to, you know, more writers and people who aren't writers, who want to be writers, to tell stories about their friendships. And, like, I am so interested and how people connect with each other and how their connections might mean different things to each person or different things to the same person throughout time. Like, I find that so fascinating. And so that part of, you know, part of me putting my stuff out there, like put out things that I want to see in the world. And, and I mean that quite literally, like I want to see other people do the same thing and write about these subjects more. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my first intention. Also, like, I want to see more bisexual stuff talked about. I want to see more biracial stuff talked about, like, although this book doesn't really delve into that. I want to see more examples of how the patriarchy affects people in the workplace. Mm-hmm. In general. And these are all things that I talk about in the book. And because I want to compare my experiences with others, as everyone does. Everyone wants to know if they're normal, if these their friendships are normal, or not even normal, but like, where do I fall on that spectrum? Like, is this, I mean, part of this, you know, me examining this friendship was like, is this normal? Like, mm-hmm. these things that we went through, is this how friendships are supposed to be? You know, it was very different than some of my other friendships. Like, are those normal? Like, what's mm-hmm. going on? Like, it's, you know, sort of a spectrum check. Like, where do I fall on the spectrum of friendships, and where, what, you know, how true was our relationship, and how true are my friendships now? Like, it's all very interesting. And, so that was really my intention, was just to put the subject matter out. But really, I've learned over time not to really talk to the reader, but just to tell my story. And the reader is going to pick up what they're going to pick up. And it's never what I think they're going to pick up. So when you're talking about, like, as a reader, like, my ears just perked up like a dog. I'm like, wait, tell me more. What did you get out of this book? What did you think of this book? Like, how did this relate to you? Have you had a friend who ghosted you? Have you ghosted a friend? Like, I'm so interested in this stuff. And
it's very important, and it kind of gets talked about in a superficial way as if it's a thing for young people. And then additionally, the idea of, like, processing, am I a good friend? Are others a good friend to me? How could I support people better? Was there anything I could have done differently? And feeling in very different places about that. I really appreciated that as well.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, it's amazing. Like, going, like, I remember being your age, but like being the age of, my first high school reunion. And a lot of people are like, high school reunions, that sucks. But honestly, I went back to my first high school reunion, and even though I didn't graduate high school, but I still went. And a lot of those people were people that I hadn't seen since middle school. So like, even in high school, I was checked out. I was hanging out with an older crowd for the most part, but my time in middle school was so fraught, and I felt like such just like the biggest loser. I thought everyone hated me. And it was really eye-opening going back to and meeting those people and realizing I was barely on their radar. Like, they didn't hate me. They didn't notice me. This was all in my head, or mostly in my head. And these people were also literal children at the time, where, you know, when I think about those times, I think about, God, being 7 years old and this like little kid, like, he was a crush of mine. And like, until he put his fist to my, he didn't hit me, but he put his fist to my face. And like, that ended my crush. And I've always, like, when I think about it back on it, I think about it with the same consciousness as I do as an adult. You know, I'm almost 50, and I'm like, but like, it still has the same impact on me. But now I have these nephews who are about that age, and I'm like, oh my God, they're little children. Like, but like, it's really hard for me to sometimes to just mesh my current knowledge with that old feeling, because it feels like it happened yesterday in some ways. But I'm like, oh, okay, this was not what I thought it was. And I think that's really useful to me now, because I think sometimes I get in my head and I think people are thinking about me a lot more than they are. And it's a huge relief to know, well, no, actually the world does not revolve around me. Yeah. And that's great. I don't want it to.
Yeah. I like how young people, well, I'm relatively young, but I like that, like, Gen Z people will use the phrase like main character syndrome. I think that it's nice to examine friendships and be like, I was a side character in this person's life, and I love that. Like, I'm a side character in many places in the world, and that is good. And I'm happy functioning that way.
Yeah, we're a main character to ourselves, and then maybe to the people that we just absolutely traumatize or absolutely like lift up. But like, I don't think we get to be a main character for some dude we sat next to in math class in sixth grade.
Oh, totally.
It's relieving.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, as a young person, like, what is like, what, like, how did you relate to like the older stuff, like the stuff like in my 40s? Like, did it seem like something that you felt like you related to, that you've been through, or was it something that you can project and see yourself going through later, or was it something that you just, I don't know, like how did that feel to read something like that?
I think that there's this kind of mainstream media perpetuated like tapering off of women after 30, where you don't really get to learn about their interiority anymore. They simply become caretakers for others in kind of our collective stories and things like that. And as much as a lot of women do go on to like have kids and spouses and pets and stuff like that, those people are all still having their own interiorities. So I like reading stories about middle-aged and older people, especially like women and feminine people having those experiences, because you don't really get to hear of that kind of sneak peek that often.
Yeah, I really like talking to people much older than me and seeing how they reflect back, because I feel like it kind of gives me a glimpse into how it might be later for me. Yeah. And it helps with the perspective, especially when things seem so traumatic or something seems like a really big deal, but like, you know, it's not going to be a big deal later. It's just not.
If you joined us partway through, I've been talking to the delightful Mari Naomi, author most recently of I Thought You Loved Me. Mari Naomi, where can people find your work online, including this book?
If you just Google my name, Mari Naomi, or do marinaomi.com, you will find this, me and my books. I also do other things, like I run these databases for the cartoonists of color, queer cartoonists, and disabled cartoonists, which are just basically what they sound like, where you can find thousands of people who fit that identity and find their stuff.
Well, thank you so much. It's been so great to have you back. Really a treat.
Thanks so much. It was really fun.
Thank you.